Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 98.
Non aginte tocto. That's Latin.
And Tom Brady wins yet another Super Bowl.
I know, I was conflicted. Those of you who do not know, Josh and I are Patriots fans. I'm from Boston. Josh is from Connecticut. And Connecticutians are weird because you can root for the New York team or the New England team. And thank God, here it's for the New England team.
That was a prerequisite for joining your family.
Yeah. But so, you know, Tom Brady was on the Patriots for forever. And then he left last year to go to Tampa Bay Buccaneers with another player, Gronk. But I went to school in Tampa, went to see Bucs games when they were terrible. So I had a few reasons to root for the Buccaneers. And they really blew the other team, Kansas City,
away.
Away.
I wonder how much of our audience is a crossover audience with people who like American football and like circus. I feel like it's probably quite a tight, you know, niche in there.
Yeah.
But hopefully you guys enjoyed it the way we did. It's kind of weird seeing a stadium with thousands and thousands of people in it, you know, in COVID era.
Yep. But I mean, the Bucs stadium is pretty cool and big, but it's just so annoying because when I was at school, all of the teams were bad and now they're all good.
I think that's good for people who follow sports franchises to have like some level of change and turnover. But we're actually going to start our show this week with another story coming not far from Tampa, but out of Orlando, about Blue Man Group, which is owned by one of our favorite companies to talk about, Cirque du Soleil. So Cirque du Soleil purchased Blue Man Group a few years ago as part of the acquisitions that TPG was making. Blue Man Group has shows all over the country and the world, whether that's in Boston or New York or Las Vegas, but they also have one at Universal Studios Orlando. Have you seen, I mean, you and I have spent some time at the various theme parks down there. Did you ever see the Blue Man Group Orlando version?
No, because I had seen it in Boston a few times. Like that was like my eighth grade birthday party was going to the Blue Man Group show. Or maybe that was, yeah, I think that was my eighth grade. But I had seen it in Boston, so I felt like we never really took the time to see it in Orlando. I think
I saw the New York version and the Vegas version, both of which as a teenager I totally enjoyed.
I mean, it's a good Vegas show.
And I think it's a good show in general. One of the Blue Men actually came and saw Babel, one of the original Blue Men who created it.
They did?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think our friend Adam might have brought one of the original Blue Men, but it was pretty cool meeting him and having him come to the dance show. In any case, they sold their company to Cirque du Soleil for about $60 million a few years ago, and now Cirque owns it. And of course, Cirque is in this jam. They've just come through this restructuring and all this going bankrupt and then having new debt, $600 million of new debt. And we've been trying to follow what will happen. And what's interesting is that Blue Man Group doesn't seem like they're coming back.
To Orlando
specifically. There was a new report put out basically trying to look at what the likelihood of it is. And what I thought was particularly interesting about it, it probably doesn't make sense for Universal Studios to continue to run the Blue Man Group show for a few reasons. One, I guess just the attendance had been going down for a number of years after having been there, I believe, for a 13-year run, which is pretty, again, those are long runs for a show if you make it to 13 years. That's nothing to like scoff at. But I think what's clear with Disney and clear with Feld Entertainment is that they really want shows and IP that people can relate to past just seeing it in the theater. So Blue Man Group is one of those things that doesn't really have a big YouTube presence or a presence on Netflix or on social media, or you don't really engage with Blue Man Group all that much other than when you go and see their shows. And Universal will likely put into that theater a show that ties in with other kinds of products they have. Looks like it'll probably be How to Train Your Dragon, because there's a How to Train Your Dragon. If you haven't seen the movie, it's actually very cute. I think there are a few How to Train Your Dragon movies, but they're going to do some kind of live show. That way it can be tied into a ride and it can be copied and put in other Universal theme parks around the world. So it's just an interesting another step in this journey of what shows will Cirque du Soleil reopen, when will they be able to reopen them, and under what conditions. And, you know, Blue Man Group is stuck the same way sort of V-Star is stuck and Cirque Dreams is stuck, all in the same boat, all run by the same organization.
Yeah, Cirque du Soleil is just an interesting company to continually talk about. And, you know, it's funny because Josh's mom was like, sometimes you sound gleeful when you talk about, you know, the downfalls of Cirque. And I don't think you are gleeful, but I do think it's more, you know, it's just consistently interesting because, I don't know, we've been doing this podcast for 5 years. And from the beginning of that, when we started, there was trouble in paradise for Cirque. And it was just such a jarring thing, right? Because you have this company that's so big and really put roots down for Circus in so many locations. And then to see it kind of go on this like downward journey is alarming and interesting. And also when you think you are following the news and following maybe the pattern of the business and then you end up being like correct, it's definitely interesting to go down that. I mean, it was like really when Guy was selling it that I felt like that's when this era kind of started of, you know, where do we go with Cirque? Who's running Cirque? Why are they buying all these companies? Are they expanding too quickly? Which is what we did think. You know, like, what's the point of buying up all these smaller companies? Are you losing the core of what you're doing? And now it's, you know, gone into bankruptcy and been kind of invigorated by someone new. Are they during COVID, during a pandemic? I mean, it kind of just continually goes. It's a really interesting story. And I think the reason Blue Man Group was originally bought for Universal was to compete against Disney's Cirque du Soleil La Nuba. And so that's also interesting, right? Because now Cirque is going to redo a show for Disney.
It's called Drawn to Life. I mean, it's still scheduled to open in the spring, according to old press releases, I think from like November or December. I'm personally quite skeptical that it will get open by the spring, given the issues with rehearsing shows, even if you're allowed to have like a half capacity in Florida. And just to go back to the comment my mom said about being gleeful about things that go bad for Cirque du Soleil, you know, I would just point that like the whole reason I'm interested in circus and fell in love with circus is because of Cirque du Soleil. And when we're gleeful or silly about it, it's because I'm happy that we're right. You know, we've been talking for 5 years into the internet with, you know, different people writing us telling me I'm right or wrong. Or it's nice to know that we're not totally off about everything. And even though I am worried about Cirque, I think it really does need to go through such a intense overhaul that trying to stay in the status quo or pretend that everything is fine, even from outside, you know, eyes and critics like us, you know, I think Cirque is going to be going through a long journey and we're still really in the middle of it. You know, I'm not so interested in just being a cheerleader, even though I do love what the company created, particularly what they created in the 90s and early 2000s. But I also understand that it's a bit of a monopoly and it has bought, like we're talking about, all these companies and has dominated the market and jacked up ticket prices, jacked up the prices that it costs to build a show, created probably unrealistic expectations in the market. And in some ways, it probably killed Ringling and killed other companies by virtue of its success and these other companies' inability to like pivot. I have a very interesting relationship with Cirque, and it'll be interesting to see their next step.
You know, I think Cirque is an important part of the landscape of contemporary circus in the United States and Canada specifically, and it is an ever-evolving story that is continually interesting and continually something to learn from and case study. I mean, when you're in school, it's like interesting to really do case studies on businesses and companies, and you learn from them. And I feel like we've been learning a lot from Cirque, and they're the only big corporate company that we can really learn from, you know. And that's the other thing. It's like, it's not really like there's other companies to talk about. We only just talk about Cirque. It's like really one of the only companies, because Feld is now a conglomerate of Disney with their ice shows and, you know, Monster Truck and stuff like that.
I don't know if conglomerate is exactly the right
legal
term. They just have a deep partnership with Disney.
Partnership.
I think conglomerate just implies that they're actually a part of the same company.
Okay. But, you know, Ringling, the circus show is no longer there. So it's really just Cirque who has these big shows. So I don't know. It shall be interesting.
I mean, I don't think I saw any news about Cirque du Soleil getting any kind of insurance payments or bailouts the way we've been getting reports this past week of various different Broadway shows who plan to return based upon their ability to get these performance cancellation insurance payouts.
Yes. So, interestingly enough, some of the biggest payouts went to what I would call maybe some of the smaller shows that were either open or opening. They include Company, which is, you know, a revival of the Stephen Sondheim musical, which I'm happy about because I had tickets to it and I want to go see it. It was like gender
bending.
Well, no, it was like gender flipped, basically. Mm. So the lead roles that were typically played by men are played by women, and one was Patti LuPone. So, you know, I definitely want to go see that. And they got like an $8 million insurance payout, which, you know, for a $13 million capitalization of your show isn't everything, but it's a huge help as far as keeping the show going and reopening, because I think it's estimated that about $4 million is what it's going to take for each show to reopen, with rehearsals and getting the theater ready and remarketing and doing the press and all that stuff. But the other shows, two that exist or three that existed already, which was Dear Evan Hansen, duh, but you know, a smaller show, Hadestown and Come From Away. And then surprisingly, Girl from the North Country, which is a new show that was in I don't even know if it had started previews. I think it's like, I want to say Bob Dylan's music, but I could be totally wrong. But it looked interesting. So that's exciting that that's coming back, because I did actually want to see that. What is on the flip side of these shows that did get insurance payouts is the Jujamson Theater Company, that owned five Broadway houses, only got $250,000 payout from Chubb.
I think we maybe talked about this 10 episodes ago, because I remember them putting in this claim back in like July, maybe, that they believed they were owed more than $250,000 and that they had tens and tens of millions of dollars of losses. Do you think they'll be eligible for the Save Our Stages money instead of the insurance money?
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, the thing that I think is a frustrating, Jordan Roth, who owns Jujamson, is that they had an insurance policy that they paid into. And, you know, they should be getting $250,000 for each of their five theaters. And Save Our Stages could probably help them as well. But, you know, I think it's the principle of it all. And what's concerning is that because all these shows got massive payouts, now the language in insurance coverage is changed and excludes specifically pandemics. And so I don't think a show will ever have the coverage of a potential virus/pandemic. We got very lucky and our insurance did cover it. Clearly a lot for Broadway covered it, but because they had to pay out so much all at once, because it happened to everyone at the same time, I don't know when we'll see that in insurance coverage again. And if it is, it's going to be like astronomically expensive.
Well, I've been having a few conversations about insurance with different people who run circus companies throughout the U.S. and whether or not they had this particular clause in it, or what they're seeing. I've seen now people have sent me their general commercial liability coverage that is also excluding pandemic coverage, which is different from the performance cancellation insurance excluding it. So, I think once we start doing new insurance policies for our upcoming circus show and for Babel, when that gets relaunched again, it'll be interesting to see what our insurer says they don't cover anymore. I mean, I think... This reminds me of an anecdote that Ross Mollison told on his episode of about a Russian producer who produced the state ballet who would insure his profits. So once the show was close to being sold out, he would go and get insurance on the profit he would make. So if the tour got canceled or the shows got canceled, he would get the profit paid out. And, you know, I don't know if that's possible to get, but I feel like producers will try to be clever in, if they can't get pandemic coverage, essentially getting other kinds of coverage that maybe aren't exact but still cover you in a worst case scenario. I mean, I think we're seeing now those who aren't covered by insurance are hoping to be covered by the Save Our Stages Act. We've talked about that a few times on the podcast. It's a section of the Restart Bill, which is the act that came after the CARES Act, for those who are really following politics and U.S. government. But basically, there are grants of up to $10 million to different kinds of venues, whether that be museums or music halls or theaters. And it's a little confusing to see if it will include circuses. It's been going back and forth over whether or not it will. It seems like It seems like it will include circuses, but for a while there was an exclusion based around if you don't have fixed seating that are bolted into the ground, could you be counted as a venue? Of course, most circuses and tents do not bolt their seats to the ground. They're on bleachers that they travel with. But then the week a bunch of circuses were right about that, New York City came back and said, actually, that definition only applies to museums. So we don't really know yet if circuses will get will be eligible for a payout, or how much that will be, and what the difference is in if basically how the Small Business Administration pays it out. So
I think that they'll be considered part of this act that you can apply. We're looking into applying. It's a little intensive, but hopefully stuff comes from it. Everything can help at this point.
We'll report back with our success or a lack thereof. But fingers crossed, guys, fingers crossed for us that we get another chunk of money to relaunch Beyond Babel with from the government. It would be wonderful if it all happens.
Yes.
If not, we'll figure it out either way.
Yes. Well, on today's podcast, our guest, Petra Massey, who is a clown, physical comedian from the UK. She is part of the legendary comedy troupe called Spy Monkey and host, maybe I would call her, of Atomic Saloon, the newest Spiegelworld show in Las Vegas. We got to see her in Atomic Saloon in October before the pandemic started, which I'm very grateful for because she was fantastic. And talking to her, I think I cried laughing maybe at least two times.
Yeah, I mean, it was really fun to do this episode after having just done Leo Bassi, because I feel like we got two angles on amazing clowns and their backgrounds. And it's interesting which things overlap, like street performing, and which things don't, particularly their style of creation method for comedy seems quite different. But it was super fun chatting with Petra, and a lot of laughs in the episode.
Yeah, I think we were also really excited to talk to her about Spy Monkey because we had just heard it from our friends who are clowns and have you heard, the Spy Monkey group, the Spy Monkey workshop, blah, blah, blah. It's like, what the heck is Spy Monkey? Like, I don't get it. And now we get it to a level you can't really get it from just, reading about it online. So it was really, really awesome to talk to her. She's so smart, so such an artist, such an interesting brain. And I had a lot of fun talking to her. So I think it's a very fun podcast to listen to. But before you listen to our podcast, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram, subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can Twitter tweet us or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. So here, without further ado, is our interview with Petra.
Well, Petra, thank you so much for coming on our podcast and chatting with us. I'm really excited to get to know you a little better. Where are you Zooming us from at the moment?
Presently from the front line in Las Vegas, in my little gorgeous neighborhood called McNeil Estates, which is about 10 minutes from the Strip. And I call it the Green Belt of Vegas. It's a delightful little area. So very lucky, with a very good community.
And you're originally from England, but where specifically?
I'm born in a little village called Paglesham, which is about half an hour. This is going to mean nothing to you, which is about half an hour from Southend, which is about an hour and a half from London. So sort of east of the east. I'm I'm not a Cockney, but I'm that end of the Cockney, to give it a little bit of mappage.
Josh's mom is from Cheltenham, if you know where that is.
Oh, Cheltenham's very posh.
It is. She's from the wrong side of the tracks in Cheltenham, as she describes it, but... Yeah. I was, was there a show of course in the UK, there's an amazing theater and comedy culture, but was there a show or shows you were seeing as a kid that sort of sparked your interest? How did you fall into the theater comedy world?
I knew when I was born that that's what I wanted to do. I don't know why. I think people say it's in your blood, and I have a line of people in my family. Not my dad. My dad wanted me to be a brain surgeon. He's a kind of engineer and wants nothing to do with performing because it was rammed down his throat when he was a kid. My grandmother, who I've never met, was a flamenco dancer. She's Basque, a flamenco dancer from Bilbao, that sort of area. And my grandfather was an opera singer and a vaudevillian kind of bit George Formby, ukulele sort of thing. And they did a lot of vaudeville, and they used to drag my dad around all of these theatrical ventures, which he sort of loved, but at the same time, he hated, because he was very much someone who would like to do things with his hands. He was a budding scientist, and they used to make him do ballet classes and, you know, singing classes, and he couldn't bear it. So the last thing he wanted his daughters to do was to go into theatre. And that's all I wanted to do from, I can't even remember. I think at the age of four, I was doing shows for my, which, you know, that's a normal thing for parents, but they didn't know how serious I was. And at the age of 10, I was producing shows, albeit, you know, for sweets, candy, in Paglesham, my local village hall. I used to get five of my friends together, and we used to put on Christmas shows and Easter shows, and I used to write it, direct it, and perform in it. And I used to dole out all the parts, and then I'd give my friends the main parts and then take it back. And then they would just end up being my background dancers. So I was incredibly precocious. In other words, I was that was all I ever wanted to do. It's all I ever knew.
It's funny you say that, because, I mean, Lindsay can tell the story herself, but she had a similar producing shows in her backyard, but would cast her sister as always the male romantic lead next.
Well, in the Disney shows, the princess has so much, and then the prince comes in at the end, you know. And so my sister's always the prince, and my dad, I would make him make the sets. But you were nicer than me. I never let anyone be the lead, except I was always the lead from the beginning.
Yeah. Okay. Similar. Yes. I think I tried to be kind. I tried to pretend to be kind, but this is such a hard and fast memory for me. I think at the age of 10, and this is a kind of when I knew that I had a dark sense of humor, even at that age, was when we were in this little local village hall, and you know, you could fit, I don't know, 30, 40 people. And this was a tiny village, and it was all full of families and babies and everything. And I did this thing where it was not a magic trick, but a comedy magic trick, where you'd fill a bucket with water and you'd set it all up, this comedy up, that you were going to throw the water over the audience. And then each time you'd go one, two, and then you wouldn't throw it. And then you'd go one, two, and then you wouldn't throw it. And all the audience would go, ooh, like that. And they're all very encouraging. But what was actually in the bucket were lollipops. So the lollipops for the kids. But it was in the height of summer, and they were, I even remember the type of lolly, that the Caramac lollipops, which is a sort of toffee lollipop. They didn't have wrapping on. And what I didn't know is when we went to throw the said bucket of water, which made everybody go, ugh, like that, and laugh, what actually happened was, instead of all the lollipops flying out in this beautiful scatter, they all rose as a lump of lollipops and landed on a baby's head. You shouldn't laugh.
I shouldn't.
It was this huge clump of lollipops that came out, and all up my little gang were like, oh, we didn't know what the fuck meant. Sorry, I'm not allowed to swear, but oh, shit. And then it just went bang on this thing. And then suddenly this baby cried. The mother picked up. Everybody was like, oh, my God, what's happened? The baby was absolutely fine. But I remember thinking, as I was watching this clump of Caramac lollipops fly through the sky, this is wrong, but this is so funny. And then my dark comedy was born.
So did you, I mean, I guess, you know, there are some people who are obviously very attracted to comedy as a form. I guess stand-up comedy would be like the most extreme version of that, at least in the US. But did you pursue it more like going to acting school and trying to take comedic roles? What was your sort of path to comedy from just being interested in being a performer?
Very much I wanted to be taken as a serious actress. My whole thing was film actress. I wanted a Golden Globe. I wanted to walk the red carpet, you know, really shallow bollocks. Sorry, I shouldn't really swear.
It's fine.
Okay. So shallow bollocks. And bollocks doesn't really mean anything in America anyway, so it's fine. Bollocks and wanker, I can say. And I used to have this movie book, so it had all the classic movie stars from, you know, from the early days of Charlie Chaplin all the way to Douglas Fairbanks and Vivian Leigh, and they were my idols, and I used to look at this book. So, and I went to drama school on a Friday night and a Saturday morning, again, from when I was the age of 10. That was my staple. That was what I lived for. I used to go to a very tough Essex comprehensive where, and I, back then I spoke quite posh when we were talking about your mum was from Cheltenham, and I had quite a good speaking voice, and I can still turn it on now when I need to. But when I went to Essex, when I went to this Rayleigh Park school, it was a very, very tough comprehensive where there was a lot of bullying involved and I got picked on a lot. So I had sort of I was kind of like split personality. At the Essex school, I learned to become extremely tough and extremely aggressive and extremely fighty. I used to fight everybody because I was very, very strong, and I used to fight. There was this place called Over the Mound. It was Over the Mound, which is basically a hillock, and where all the fighting used to go on. So everybody used to fight each other behind the mound, so nobody could, none of the teachers. So that was my weekday life, where I was, I got bullied very badly, and then I ended up befriending the bully.
Were you bullied because of your accent?
I was bullied because I was very posh. Oh. I was extremely posh. Everyone else sort of talked like that, like, all right. And I spoke terribly like that. And immediately, if you speak like that, that immediately says class and money and where you live and mm-hmm. all of those things. So I learned very quickly to go from this to, all right, yeah, I'm all right. So that in a way, that was like where my reality acting world started to exist. So I had that existence. And then when I was at my drama, like on a Friday night and a Saturday morning, when I actually felt truly who I was with all my theatre people, that's when I spoke my normal voice, whatever that was, which is probably what it is now. But I knew how to play both roles. I started sort of acting. And in some ways, it was very confusing because for a long time, I didn't really know who I was. Was I this tough, you know, little Essex kind of tearaway, or was I this theatrical? And in fact, the answer is both very much. And those sorts of characters, I play this little bloke character, and I'm very good at playing little aggressive men. And it's because of my upbringing, but I'm also very good at playing posh birds. So I kind of, you know, in a way, it was a massive theatrical learning curve for me. I mean, those are the only two stock characters I can play really well, but I do it. Can't do anything else.
So when you left home and wanted to start pursuing this professionally, what was like your first dip into not doing it in a school context, but doing it in an onstage paid gig, now I'm an actress kind of context?
So I went to Middlesex University and I did a BA honours in performance art. During that time, I decided that, again, quite young, I suppose, that I didn't want to be waiting on an agent to find me work. And I was also passionate about street performing, particularly Covent Garden, which is where everybody used to go. So I used to go with my notebook as a kid. My mum used to take me because we were only an hour away on the train. And I used to take my notebook and write notes about all the acts that I like. And then at college, I put together a street performing show, which I toured. We toured while we were at college in France over the summer. We got a single decker bus, me and my girlfriends. We painted it purple and we drove from England to Paris to the south of France. It was like, you know, the most amazing adventure. And we got into all sorts of terrible trouble, really bad trouble, because I think I'd only just passed my driving test. And it was a proper, you know, those London
huge
buses.
It
was like one of those,
one?
But single. Well, it was actually my friend, Mandy Cullen, who was from my school. She bought it and said, and she knew we wanted to go to the south of France and do our street show. And she said, do you want to come with me? And we said, yeah. So there was the three of us girls and Mandy Cullen. And we were all kind of 17, 18. And we all had the summer in France riding around in this bus, getting into a lot of trouble. in Paris, I think in particular, we got into a lot of trouble. We were driving around, I think, the Arc de Triomphe the wrong way.
Oh, no, in a double-decker bus.
In a double-decker bus. Purple, yeah, yeah. And I think in another one, we misjudged a fairground. And we were driving through a fairground and we didn't realise, but all the electrics were really, really low and we didn't know the way out. So we drove through and without realising, we ripped all the electrics with us and the whole fairground just died. There was no lights, there was no machines, there was no, and we had no idea until we looked behind us and there was like an angry throb of Frenchies going, oh, merde, qu'est-ce que tu fais? Oh, putain de merde! Chasing afterwards, saying, give us our fairground back. And then we had to pay quite a lot of cash out as a way of apologising.
So a quick question on the street show. Our guest on the episode right before you is Leo Bassi, who's a Spanish clown.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about street performing on his episode. And he said two things that I'm wondering if you can relate to. One is that he said street performing was incredibly freeing for him. But on the flip side, he felt like he couldn't, it took much more time to go into anything complicated or challenging with the audience because of the amount of time it takes to build and set up the show before you get it going. Do either of those themes sound like they resonate with you at all?
Totally, and more to add. But first of all, Leo Bassi was an inspiration of mine. I saw his shows quite early on. I just thought, and in theatre shows, actually, more than outdoor shows, amazing. So for me, being one of the very few back then solo street performers that was travelling around the world, there weren't that many. I would first of all agree that it is very freeing. I literally traveled around the world for 4 years. I was only supposed to go for a year. I ended up traveling for 4 years, doing my shows all over the world, making friends all over the world, having this incredible experience and being able to make money from my art, from my work. And then also because I was like the token solo female street performer, I would get flown from one country to another because I would win street performing competitions because, you know, they were just, I don't think I was particularly good, but I think it was more about being the token female. And so, yes, it felt very free. I had an urge to travel as much as I had an urge to perform. And the both of them went hand in hand. And you could do anything within reason on the streets. The subtlety, and I, in fact, a teacher of mine at Middlesex Poly always said to me, be very careful, you will lose your subtlety on the streets. John Wright, he's got a book on how to be stupid. And he said, you know, you have to be very big and very gregarious and very loud, very sometimes very generic. There were very generic street lines, which, you know, bottling. When you end a street show, you do what's called a bottle, so you get money. And I was very aware, that always stuck in my head. I think in Europe, you could be more subtle and find more interesting. There was street performing was more respected in Europe. And there was a lot more creativity. But I think in Australia and America and Canada and England, it wasn't. It was much more generic. So that was one of the reasons why I stopped street performing, is because I felt like I was getting in a rut and I was just delivering. And I just wasn't having any fun anymore. I did it for about, from when I was about 18 to my mid-20s, and travelled the world for 4 years with my, I did an escapology routine. I escaped from the backpack of freedom. And I remember getting back after this incredible time away, and I was doing some street performing show in Bradford in February with it pissing down with rain with Bobo the Clown and someone else just sitting there thinking, no, I'm done. This is just no fun anymore. I'm not getting anything out of this. And I made a very conscious decision to stop, which was difficult because, you know, I was making good money. I was doing really well because I had a solo theatre show as well. So I would publicise my street show, my theatre show that I'd do in the evenings with my street show in the day, which was great because it was word of mouth and I'd give flyers out. And I was very industrious, I think, looking back at it. I was my own social media machine. But I used it like, you know, word of mouth and verbal and street show. And I used to perform publicity stunts when they wouldn't allow me, like in, there's a place in New Zealand called Manners Mall where I used to perform, and they banned me because my crowds were too big, and it stopped the punters going into their shops. So the man in the record shop, the Tandy man, the donut man, I think the local supermarket, they all went to the town hall to ban me from performing. And I was performing my show Panic in the evening at Bats Theatre, which was all about panic. And I had a bed that I used to, that was my set. So what I did instead, I was so naughty, was I dragged my bed. I dressed up in my pajamas because that was my costume for my show. And I dragged my four-poster bed through Manners Mall, chained to it. I was chained to it, giving out flyers. So I wasn't performing a street show, and it was moving, and everyone knew me because it was such a small little thing. So I could still publicize my street show, and there was nothing they could do. They were so angry. They hated me. Those people that worked in those shops absolutely hated me. I was such a maverick. Yeah.
At what point did you go from, you know, wanting to be a serious award-winning actor to then being like, I'm going to do street shows and, you know, a one woman show? Cause to me, the, like, you know, the actors who want to be in the, you know, taken legitimate and like hang on to that dream, even if that's maybe not the route that they should be taking, but like, that's like what they want. So they'll audition only for those roles and kind of be closed off to the other options of performance out there. So at what point did you say, like, actually, I like doing something different?
I think it was over a period of doing street performing and realizing that I was good at making people laugh. And I really enjoyed hearing laughter. That really gave me a big thrill. And sort of being introduced a little bit to clown. I studied with this guy just for 2 weeks, Philippe Goliot, who's the French guru. I did quite well in that clown class, and he's sort of known for not particularly liking women, slightly apparently misogynist, which I don't know if that's true or not, but so that kind of chimed for me. But also I was pretty realistic, you know. I knew that I wasn't a particularly brilliant actress. I was all right. But there were many other actors that were very, very good, even at college, that, you know, you would just be a bit in awe of. I remember this girl, Jo Johns, she was in my class. No one particularly liked her, but she was an excellent actress. And there was no way I felt like I could get to that level. But I thought, well, with comedy, I can. In fact, there was a teacher there who used to sort of have some sort of dealings with Monty Python. Or the Monty Python gang. I can't remember his name, but he really took a shine to me. He thought that I had real potential as a comic, which then I didn't really appreciate because I was so wanted to be an actress. So it was a slow sort of infiltration from around of about, you know, when I started earning money from street performing through to traveling around the world for 4 years and just going in a very different vein. I was always very physical, extreme. You know, I remember in Australia, I was asked to do a publicity stunt where I jumped out of a plane naked, 10,000 feet, for a safe sex publicity stunt. I loved it. Oh, I loved it. It was brilliant. It was very funny because I was attached to someone else behind me because I did a tandem jump and he was naked. The pilot was naked and everyone else that jumped was naked. And I had to have two rubber johnnies on my hands that said safe sex and hold them up to the camera as we were free falling down. And the shock on my face, because I didn't realize that as you free fall down, as fast as you go down, when your chute goes up, you go up even faster. And when you're naked and that harness goes like that, it was really shocking. So I knew that to combine my physicality and my comedy and my acting skills, because I think as a clown, you have to be able to act well. You actually really genuinely have to be able to act. You have to be able to sell it. So that was a kind of, I think, quite early on, I would say, in my 20s. And also, there weren't, again, that many comedians, like stand-up. There was a I did a bit of stand-up for a while. There was a huge lack of female comedians. So I felt like, why battle with all these amazing actresses when you're, you know, you're not, you don't look particularly different. You're not a great actress. Why battle through all of that when you can have this much more fun road as a comedian?
How did circus fall into your path, though?
Well, I always say I kept running away from the circus and the circus kept chasing me. I never particularly wanted to be in the circus. And not for any reason. I think it's just because you have to work really hard. And the freedom. I just like the freedom of doing my own stuff, making my own material, writing my own shows. So my first venture to circus, oh, well, there's actually Mark Lucas. The first one was when I was in my 20s, and it was a friend of mine, Matt Churchill, who bought a tent, and this other woman, Flick Ferdinando, and they were a couple at the time. And they bought a tent, and they wanted to put this circus. They got me in. I think they got me in to direct it first. So I helped direct this circus called Mama Loves Ya. And it was a very fringe, small sort of circus that traveled all around England, which I really enjoyed. And then they asked me to be in it. And so the following year I was in it and I was a kind of acrobat. I did the teeter board, which is the seesaw thing. You know it all, yeah. With this woman, Australian woman, her name was Carrie Bagg. And she was like 6'1", 6'2". She had a neck the size of Mike Tyson. And she was my comedy double act. And I played a little bloke, this little like ratsy bloke. And I'm only 5'2", 5'3". And she was huge. And she played this, you know, this my girlfriend. And we did this whole teeter board act where I would go on the teeter board and then she'd come on, bang it. And I'd just fly up in the air. And then when I went to try and do it to her, nothing moved. I mean, she was huge, this woman. So we had this great double act. So that was my first venture into circus, which I loved. And I was very much creating the material. So that suited me. And then, but never really wanted to circus. And then I was working with this company in Switzerland called Karl's Corner Gassenschau, which means Karl's Big Bold Street Show. And they do outdoor spectacular shows, which are in quarries and in car parks and with arenas like, I don't know, it was like 2,000 seater arenas. And they got approached by Circus Canis to do a show, which is an animal circus. And I was with Karl's Corner Gassenschau at the show at the time. And they asked me if I wanted to be involved. And I said, yeah. So then I ended up in Circus Canis for 9 months with my fellow Spy Monkey. Spy Monkey hadn't formed by then. I was working with Aitor Basauri. And it was extraordinary, this experience, because we traveled everywhere in a train. Even the animals, it was an animal circus. So Kimberly the giraffe would go in the train, Sheila the rhinoceros, 22 Chinese plate spinners, the little dwarf Speedy, who kept getting drunk and falling off the train, and the tigers, the lions. We all traveled around in a train and we worked for 9 months. I think over 9 months, I had 11 days off. So sometimes I've worked 3 months without a day off every single day, two shows a day, and that 2.5 hour shows, and then take the show down and then all get loaded into a train and off we'd go to the next place. And I got so ill because I worked so hard. I ended up on a diet of coconut, carrots, and what was the other thing? Oh, yeah, coconut, carrots and parsley. That's all I ate until my hands went orange. And I was performing a high wire act on a bike. Luckily, I was attached and I fainted because I'd lost so much blood because I hadn't been eating properly. I wasn't very good at looking after myself back then. I'm still not. I don't cook. I'm a shit cook. So I wasn't really eating. So my body was craving nutrients. And that's what I ended up eating until I ended up in the hospital.
You fainted while you were on the high wire?
I fainted while I was on the high wire because it was this bicycle act. So I was on the bike and we were playing, interestingly, part of the European community the communion before Brexit happened, which was a bit of a thing. And I was playing a Margaret Thatcher type character riding on this bike. So I was there to inspect the circus and to tell them with all my European communion community and to tell them if they passed or not. And then I had Marcus, who was underneath me on the thing, who wasn't supposed to be there. He was a stowaway. And then this whole bike, because of the weighted balance, would turn around like that on the high wire. And it was a good, I would say it was a good, I'd say 5-6 meters up, you know, I mean, it was a good fall. And then I fainted and I kind of fell off the bike, but I was strapped onto it. And I can't really remember everything. And then I was rushed to hospital. So it was all very exciting.
So we've seen, I've seen Kenny maybe 3 or 4 times. I think Lindsay has seen it once. You've seen Kenny?
Yeah, maybe twice.
And one thing I've noticed about the clowns in Kenny is that they do multiple languages at the same time, often for the French, Italian, German, English speaking people in the audience. Yeah. But also yeah. that I feel like the Swiss taste of humor is very different from like the English yes. like taste for humor. And I'm yeah. wondering if you can speak to that at all. If, you know, traveling around Europe, being with the shows, if you feel like different countries laugh at different things.
Very much so. Well, I have two experiences. I have my experience before Spy Monkey and then my experience with Spy Monkey. So with Kenny and with Karlskrona Gassenschau, I think one of the reasons why they got me in and they got Toby in, who's also from Spy Monkey now, that's how we all met, and Aitor, who's Spanish, is to have that flavour and to have that language. So we'd have German, Spanish, Swiss German, which are two different languages, English, Italian. So that was very much the flavour. And I suppose that's also where Spy Monkey got their flavour as well, because within our company, it's a Spanish, a German and an English. And we all speak different languages as well. I speak French. Toby speaks German. I speak a bit of German. So language is a really playful thing and can really also really endear an audience, especially if you go to their country and you make the effort to speak the language, which I think everyone should. And it's a very playful thing and a very powerful thing, language. And it's also charming in some ways, that I would say a bit of a false charm, but there is a charm to it, especially because of the accent and the effort that's made to try and learn languages. Humor wise, there was a lot of translation. With Karlskrona Gassenschau, they had a very inventive format to their shows. I would call them boys with toys. They would just make incredible things. And health and safety just doesn't even exist in Switzerland. They'd like literally burn forests down and get away with it and shoot rockets out. And, you know, it was like the Mad Max, James Bond Mad Max of outdoor theatre. And they started as street performers. But they let us because, you know, England has such a good reputation for comedy, they kind of gave us carte blanche for our comedy antics. And as long as, and I would learn Swiss German and translate everything into Swiss German or do very kind of international humour that would translate to the Swiss Germans. But they're not big laughers, the Swiss Germans, and trying to wring out a laugh from them sometimes was quite complicated. And I have to be careful because I ended up marrying a Swiss German man. And we have a very different sense of humour and clash. In fact, what it is with the Swiss Germans, and it still takes me ages, even with my husband, is it's incredibly dry. The sense of humour is so dry.
And direct. So direct.
Yeah. Dry and direct. And I end up saying, like, Rog says things to me. I'm like, that's really hurtful. And then he realises that he's joking. I'm just like, that's not funny. It's just too real. So, yeah, we don't really get on very well. I'm not actually sure why I married him, to be honest, but we're still together after 20 years.
There's a lot of Swiss Germans in Josh's family.
Yeah. I was born in Zug, in a Swiss.
Oh, Zug.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I had to get used to it because, you know, Americans are so passive aggressive, a lot of New Englanders. Yes. And when I went into his family.
A lot of Germans.
And Israelis, so very, very direct. And I was like, oh, my God, they're so rude to me.
Yes, I know. No, that is their way. It takes. But they're also Swissies are very loyal and they're still my dearest friends in Switzerland. And they're incredible people. You know, they were environmentalists before it became trendy. They just respect the land and they respect, you know, they're all born and bred farmers. I mean, my husband was brought up on a farm and I think he's lived in a house that is 800 years in the family. and it's this most exquisite place. I've lost track.
It's okay. I want to ask you about Spy Monkey for a moment. So before I knew you or knew of you or knew of Spy Monkey, I had a bunch of friends who were clowns either in theater school or in Las Vegas. And I always heard rumblings about like Spy Monkey. Like, have you taken those workshops? Do you know those things they do at Spy Monkey? And it felt very much like, what is this like comedy secret that all these clowns are talking about that I have no idea what they're referencing. I'm wondering if you could tell a little bit about the creation of Spy Monkey, but also like the philosophical comedic attitude you guys like what the approach is that you guys have.
Yeah. So Spy Monkey formed from that company that I was talking about, Carl's Corner Gossenthal. That's where we met. Toby, who was already in Carl's Corner Gossenthal, and me and Aitor, who auditioned and got the part. And we were in a terrible show that was dying on its ass every night. And so that's where our relationship formed. We had a graph where we'd mark how many laughs we got each night. And Aitor always won, who's the fat Spanish clown. Hairy as well. And so then we decided to form our own company. And actually, we got the Swiss guy from Carl's Corner Gossenthal to come and join us, who ended up leaving because he missed Switzerland so much. And we ended up getting Stefan Kreis from Germany, and we auditioned him and we made him do Hitler impersonations. He was brilliant, and he was the only German in the audition, so he got the job. And then we got the brilliant and genius Cal McChrystal on board to direct us, and the brilliant and genius Lucy Bradridge on board to do set design and costume, and thus Spy Monkey was formed very early on. And we did our first show, Stiff, Undertaking, which was inspired by the Burke and Hare stories of the body snatchers. I don't know if you know that story. It's brilliant. Set in Edinburgh, where they got money for dead bodies, Burke and Hare, for the doctors to perform experiments on them. But then they ran out of dead bodies. So they just go and find people like peasants and prostitutes and kill them and then bring them back. So we used that as a comedic, you know, thing. But then that quickly changed to funeral directing and being directors of for funeral. And Toby, cleverly directed by Cal in the early days, was always going to be the straight man because he was very good looking. He was a very good actor. He was very talented, but he was very straight. So, and as much as he railed against that because he wanted to be the funny one, Cal was very, very strict about him being in that because it's all about your dynamic within a group. And then me, Aitor, and Stefan were very much the clowns, the idiots. So that and that's still to the same day. Toby will always be the straight man, and he's the best straight man in the business. And Cal taught him very cleverly. He made Toby sit there and talk about bridges because he could talk about anything. He's incredibly bright. But he just talked about bridges and he wasn't allowed to laugh. Every time he laughed, he had to sort of do this with his face. You can't really see me, but every time he laughed, he had to go, oh, like that. And he sort of developed his straight man through the joy of not being able to laugh at being so straight and not being able to laugh at us because he's a terrible corpser. He just laughs even if you say tits or bum, he just starts laughing. So that's kind of how Spy Monkey was born, through that in 1998, I think, 99. What was the next question you were asking?
Well, like, what is I would say, like, how do you guys approach it comedy-wise? Do you all write the material yourselves? Are you...
Yes. So we're very director-led. So we worked with Cal for the first, I would say, 10 years, something like that, and with Lucy, and Lucy's still on board, and Cal we still work with every now and then. In fact, Cal directed Atomic Saloon, so we still work with him in different capacities. We make shows collaboratively. We, like, for example, with Stiff, we came up with this story that we were inspired by, and then we sit in a room and workshop it and rehearse and make material through games, through playing games, through writing exercises, through looking at the internet and resources. And we'll take, back then we would take 6 weeks, something like that, to develop the show. our process has changed over the years. So now we'll probably take shorter time, but then we'll throw it out to an invited audience of friends and people who we respect their opinion, and then kind of gear the show, because so much part of the rehearsal is listening to the audience laugh for a clown show, listening to where the energy sinks and where the energy comes alive. We also have these techniques which we call bankers. So there's stuff in the show where we know will work 100%, and they're the bankers. So we could fit that around something that we know we will probably die on our ass first, and then we'll have a banker to see us through. And failing in spectacular ways. I mean, the clown is all about failing in a spectacular way, in a joyous way, and not taking it to heart, learning from it, but not taking it to heart as both an actor and a clown. And pleasure, huge amount of pleasure at being so bad, which we're all kind of aficionados at now. You know, I've spent a lifetime failing, and you still are vulnerable, and it's still painful. It never stops being painful, but you learn to know how to run with that and make that a positive thing rather than a negative thing. Otherwise, you would just slash your wrists and never get out of bed. Because there's nothing worse than, you know, being in a sea of people who are looking at you like they hate you when you're trying to make them laugh.
I think being a comedian of any kind, a clown, like a stand-up, is probably the hardest and most scary thing I could imagine doing. I think I'd rather bungee jump than be a stand-up comedian, for sure.
Yeah. Well, Aitor says comedy is a very serious business.
One question that I asked Leo that I'm curious if it's the same for you or not is, when you're thinking of, we're going to make a new show, a new act, do you approach it from, this is like a, like, where do you start with the idea? He said that he starts with thinking about, like, politically or what the current topics are that he wants to address, and then finds a comedic route to address it. Or do you guys start, like, with a comedic premise, kind of like The Undertaker sounds more like a premise you guys started with? So where does the when you're really coming up with the next show, how do you pull that original idea out of thin air?
It comes all so haphazard. Like, Stiff was the first show we ever did was a very kind of, probably the first time that we actually went, okay, this is the idea. Cooped, the second show, that came from Cal. That was very much Cal wanting to do, because Cal loves camp and he wanted to do a gothic novella. So that was sort of his inspiration. But, you know, like Moby Dick, when we did Houston's Moby Dick, that was coming driving back in a van after doing a show, and Stefan talking about how he used to play Captain Ahab with... he used to pretend he was, when he was a kid, that he had a washing up bowl, a plastic washing up bowl that he used to sit in. And he used to make his brother push it along and pretend that he was in a boat. And from that, we decided that we wanted to do the classic novel Moby Dick, which had no female parts in it whatsoever. So that was the challenge, was for me to try and get into that show as a mermaid, as a puppeteer, as whatever. So the problems that you face are very much the comedy gold that you have. If there's a problem, that's brilliant for a clown. They always come up differently. They come up when we're in a van. They come up, you know, when we're just chatting over the phone. Someone might suggest something to us that sort of takes our fancy, and then we run with it. Oedipussy came, that was from Emma Rice, who's a very well-known and respected director in England. She had Knee High, which is a well-known company. She came to us, and we came to her, and we wanted to do more structure. That's how that came, because everyone said, look, you're really funny, but the stories are crap because you just don't respect a story, because we just love crashing a story. And not doing it. So she wanted to kind of really embed us in a story, and what better story than any Greek tragedy? So she decided that we were going to do Oedipus, And then she chained that to eat a pussy, which we realized when you say that in America has a whole different meaning. And then we realized we might never be able to tour that show in America because it sounds like eat a pussy.
It does. And, so I thought I was like, oh, that's a fun name of a show. Yeah.
I know. And we had no idea. So the ideas for the show comes from different people, not always from us, from outside directors, from friends of ours that say, oh, you should do this. And they're never, you know, like Leo Messi, he's got a real God. He must be having a field day right now politically. But, you know, we don't sort of, for us, it's just got to be out and out funny with something that is endearing to us and moving. And we do like to move an audience as much as we like to make them laugh. But also horror. We had a little venture doing a horror, in a sort of experiential sort of horror show, which was really amazing to play with the timing of horror, fear and comedy, which are very different. And we were quite successful to the point where this great big guy, we were performing in Blackpool, and it was actually quite terrifying what we were doing because we were allowed to have blackout because we weren't performing in a theatre. And we did this thing where the audience came in and I was playing, what was her name? Something, a German called, what was my name? Benedict von Essen Drinkenwater or something. And I was a very sort of sadomasochistic sort of character. And I'd bring all these people into the room. And I can't remember exactly what happened, but it went to complete blackout. And this is like within 5 minutes of our first opening night. And then suddenly Eitel came in with a torch saying, everything will be okay, everything will be okay. And he was just flashing this torch on various things with this sound effect. And meanwhile, I'd gone and get changed. Do you know that film? I think it's Look Back, Don't Look Now. And she wears a little red duffel coat and she looks like a child. But when she turns around, she's like that, really old, ugly. And so they had this torch and suddenly you saw this rat like move along and it looked really realistic. And then me turning around like this and this rat eating my face. And then in the darkness, we heard this scream and this woman going, help, turn the lights on, my husband's fainted quickly. But everyone thought it was part of the show. It wasn't. Her husband, big guy from Blackpool, northern lad, fainted flat out on the ground from fear. Oh, it was brilliant.
Yeah, there's this genre. I don't know what the right word for it is, other than that I've just seen it on stage in my life, of like terror clown is a word I've heard for it. But this like, I don't know how to describe it genre wise, but when you're basically doing things so awful in a way, often if you're using fake bodily fluids, for example, would be a way that it might be considered awful, how you can like reach a new level of comedy and conversation in that type of genre. I'm thinking in my head of Rosewood, who is a performer in New York who worked at a nightclub called The Box, but she would do many of these kinds of acts, like where her teeth would fall out or something, you know, which is like, it's in a way, it's like terrifying to watch, but also like very comedic in nature.
Yes. That's sort of more edging towards kind of bouffant, which I also love. Like it's really gross and Box is brilliant for that. I used to know Raven.
I definitely want to ask you about Zumanity. I know Raven pretty well as well. maybe offline. I'll tell you offline. I don't want to say it on the podcast, but I'll tell you what Raven, when we're done recording, used to intro my act when I was working at The Box with. It's too dirty for me to repeat. But how did Zumanity? How did Cirque du Soleil find out about Spy Monkey, and what was that like being part of the Zumanity creation?
Well, Cal had worked with Varakai the year before with Mookie and Claudio. He was the comedy consultant and clown director for that show. And then they asked him to do the new show, Zumanity. And Cal basically said, if I come back, then I want to work with Spy Monkey. That's the deal. So they came to see us in Edinburgh and we had a big sort of runaway success at the festival. And they said yes. So that was great because not only did they have all four of us, but they also took on Lucy Bradridge, our brilliant set designer and costume designer. So we were like our own little Spy Monkey Island, which was really useful within the machine of Cirque du Soleil. So we were very much of doing our own thing in our own room. In fact, they put a note up on the door that said, clowns at work, do not enter, because we were doing some really, some stuff in there, really naughty stuff. Because we just went from fringe, like shopping in Brick Lane Market and buying coats that cost 50p, to suddenly having a rehearsal budget for costumes of $20,000. It was like, what do we even do with this sort of money? It was ridiculous. So we just went from this small fringe. Hang on one sec. Rog, do you mind? I can't really hear because you're clanking. Sorry, babes. I'm really sorry. I can't hear properly.
Sounds like us. I'm always like, can you please be quiet?
I know. I just can't concentrate otherwise. I have very little brain, so it's really hard for me to concentrate. I'll do all of that later, Rog. Sorry. What was I saying?
Talking about no clowns allowed inside the cirque.
Yes, no clowns allowed.
But can you explain, because unfortunately I never got to see Zumanity, and I don't know if I ever will. But for people who didn't see it, I know sort of what it is, but can you explain like the premise of the show?
Yes. So it was Cirque du Soleil's attempt at a sexy show. It was called, I remember, Zumanity, The Other Side of Cirque du Soleil. And they brought in exotic beauties, male and female, from all over the world. And they were stunning, stunning performers, stunning acts. And it was a very different show from the normal Cirque, because they didn't dress us up to look like an umbrella Cirque show, where they were getting these beautiful people in and then just putting ridiculous fat costumes on them and painting their faces blue and pink. So they had no identity whatsoever. So this was, but with that, they brought a lot of personalities, which weren't necessarily Cirque personalities. They were people who had, like Joey Arias, who'd been creating and making shows like us. So they kind of came up against a lots of creativity confrontation, I suppose. And the premises of the show was a journey through sexuality. So Joey was the MC, who was amazing. And it was all supposed to be very seductive and very sensual. And the acts were all about sensuality. Some, I think, worked really well. Others, I don't know how well it worked. I think it was a success at the time, I would say. People really liked it. And I still have fantastic relationships with so many Zoomans, and now being back in Vegas again, you know, I'm seeing some of them. They're my next door neighbors. I have 20 year history with these guys, and it was an amazing experience. And I thank Cirque du Soleil for giving me that experience, which was again another extraordinary experience. Cirque du Soleil wasn't really our cup of tea as far as Spy Monkey goes, because we were not able to do the kind of comedy that we wanted to do. For Cirque, clown seems sometimes to be about the poetry of the inner child. Mm. But, you know, the sensibilities were very different. We thought they brought us in very much for the edginess and the, you know, the kind of we can do anything. But actually, it turned out that we were quite contained. We had to be quite contained within our role as Cirque du Soleil. And again, one better word, suck the corporate cock. You know, when you are given a job and you are paid to do that job, you do that job and you don't ask questions and you just get on with it. And that's not really where we come from. But we did it and we really got a huge amount out of it. And sadly, the show was closed, which is a shame, because, you know, that show had been going for 20 years. But I think it had, because, you know, people get changed in and changed up. It had lost, when I went to see it again, it had lost its flavour, but of course, from the original. You know, the original was this exciting new venture with these people that had just been together for the first time. And then when you replace and replace and replace, then like any product, it will lose its essence and its flavour. And when I saw it, it felt a little bit like coming to see a show in a convention centre.
Mm.
But at the same time, I say that with huge respect for the people that had been in that show for 20 years, like, and done every single show, which I just think is amazing. I mean, that is that's work.
What was it like getting the, like, presumably offer or like opportunity to go back to Vegas? Were you like, no, I did that? Or were you like, no, I want to go back?
It was really mixed because we've got a kid. I remember the night because we were having dinner. Cal was over and he said to me, I've got an idea for a show in Vegas that I might be interested in. I want to get all these beautiful, beautiful people. And then I want you to be the ugly hag in it. And I went, oh, yeah, well, that's going to need a lot of makeup, Cal. But yeah, I'm interested. I thought he was joking. And then I had a chat with Roger about it because Roger was here with me last time. And I just said, Cal's talking about this show in Vegas. And I'm sure it won't come to anything. But what if we were to go to Vegas? What would you think about that? And he said, oh, I'd love it. I'd jump at it. I went, really? He went, yeah, I love Vegas. I said, okay, well, I might pop in an email. So I popped him an email. And then about a week later, I got a contract from Spiegelworld saying, sign here. I was like, oh, shit. And I, you know, I'm with Spy Monkey. That's my baby. That's my company. They're my brethren. They're the godfathers of my child. And we were about to do a show in Florida. And I was, I think, more conflicted than I'd ever been in my entire life about what I should do. Because of we weren't in a particularly brilliant financial situation. The idea of going to Vegas did titillate me. And to be a sort of headlining in a brand new show. And the experience for my kids, you know, to have that experience and an opportunity. And at the time, it was just going to be for a year. So I just thought, blah, I'm going to talk to Spy Monkey about it. So I did. And it was really hard. And I felt like a traitor. And, you know, they go very, very deep with me, the company. And but they kind of understood. They were angry and we went through all echelons of tears and upset. And I still miss them terribly. In fact, I've got you probably can't see it, but there's a lonely monkey that I found in the thrift store. That picture right by the lamp. It's just a lonely monkey sitting on a bench, which is me. Because I do feel like a lonely monkey and I miss them terribly. But I just felt like, you know, there's life and then there's your company. And I just felt like I need to do this. I need to jump on this. I need to do this as a life experience. And I was still totally in the throes of Spy Monkey. Didn't want to leave. But I also, like, you know, you need to seize opportunities. And that's what it felt like. Then I didn't realize that I would be in a pandemic. And now I've been here 2 years. So the idea was I was going to come back in a year. But actually, I'd said to Spy Monkey, I want to do one more year. So we'd sort of agreed to that. But I didn't think it would be one more year during a pandemic where I lose my job. I'm on unemployment insurance and about to be evicted from my home. So that was a bit of a surprise. But I'm still very much in touch with them. And we talk about new shows and what we're going to do. I will go back just at the moment. The only thing that's certain is uncertainty.
Yeah.
And yeah. I've taken the word definite out of the dictionary.
Were you living in England at the time and then moved over here?
Yeah, I was living in, we just moved to Hove to live literally next door to Lucy Bradridge, who's the set designer and also dear friend. And I'm the godmother of her new kid, Bonnie. And, you know, setting our lives up there. So, you know, literally sort of laying our roots because I'd been traveling around a lot and I wanted Richard to have sort of stability and go to the same school. You know, all of those things that you think that's what you should be doing. And he'd already been to two schools because we were living in London before that and, you know, making a life for ourselves by the sea. And it was beautiful and we loved it. And then this opportunity came and we just thought, and if Rog hadn't have said, oh, I'm up for that, if he'd have said no way, then I probably would have actually listened to him for the first time. But I didn't. And the fact that he was so excited about it and then Cal sort of going, come with us, come with us. And he told me about his experience when he was a kid, that he went to America at Richard's age. And he said it was life forming for him because it just opened a whole new world. And Richard is just doing so well here. So I think it was a work decision, but more than that, it was a life decision to seize these opportunities. And I don't regret it, although I miss Spy Monkey and I'm sad that I haven't been involved. Spy Monkey is still thriving, still hugely and highly respected, and it lives on without me, and will, because it's a very strong foundation, a very strong structure, thanks to Toby and our brilliant producer, Emily Coleman, and all the people that have worked for Spy Monkey over the years. It stands alone. And also, you know, we have spoken a lot about the fact that sometimes, to our detriment, Spy Monkey is known as just the four of us, and that we actually do have to start opening out for A, to offer more diversity and more offer more employment, to make the product of Spy Monkey exist that's not just the four of us, because we're a proper troupe in the true sense of the word, where we've done every single show for 20 years, like, you know, Monty Python or something like that. And it's time to open that out. And I did that by throwing a massive spanner in the works, and they hate me for it.
But so we got lucky and saw Atomic shortly after it opened. And
yes,
first
and
of all,
pregnant,
it was,
didn't know it, and was having those really nice cocktails.
Oh, those massive cocktails.
Yeah, thanks, Ross.
And it's super cool what they've done to the venue. But maybe you could tell us, and for people who, you know, are looking forward to seeing shows when we return, like a little bit about the character you play in that show and what it's about.
Yeah, I was thinking about when you were talking about the character that you did in the like horror show.
Yes.
Your character in Atomic Saloon is so well rounded in a way. It feels very grounded. Right. And when you came up to like slide down the pole, mm-hmm. you know, you came into our little like area, our box. Yeah. And I was like worried. Because I was like, oh my God, like, what's she going to do? You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was, you were
quite
such a
terrifying.
Real character. And it was, which is, I think, like, such a, you know, a positive and, you know, applauding to you, that I was like, like, worried about, you know, you being in the box with us. It's like, oh no.
Right. Yeah. Scared you, basically. Which isn't, you know, I have to say, I'm still finding my feet with that character. I'm still learning what she is and how she is and how she works. And I, you know, it was cut short after 8 months. I had, like at the beginning, I was playing her with an English accent, and that just wasn't working. And also, I didn't have Spy Monkey, and I'm used to having a troupe of four of us. Mm. Suddenly, I was a solo performer and working with this guy, Damien. And I, Damien was kind of a bit like, although very funny, sort of a bit like the straight man, really, because I'm a bit more of an idiot to him. But I've never really led a show in that way without Spy Monkey. So that was a really different dynamic and something that I struggled with, if I'm honest, and that I had to really kind of find. And I'm still finding it. I think at the beginning, I was way too aggressive. There were times that I was way too aggressive because it was like trying to keep in control. Mm. But, you know, after doing 10 shows a week, I kind of relaxed into it a bit more. I started, actually, just before the pandemic hit, I started to find my way a bit. And I think, I haven't really spoken to Folky, but I think he had the same things with the gazillionaire. At the beginning, the gazillionaire character didn't really totally work, and he had to really find his way. And I'm still feeling the audience as well. It's a very different audience for what I'm used to in theater land. This is cabaret. This is cabaret circus.
And it's the Vegas audience, yeah. Specifically.
And it's a very Vegas different audience. And they have mobile phones, and they actually film you, watch you through their mobile phone, which I found appalling. And I got quite angry about that. Because I'm like from theater land, where people are told to turn their mobile phones off, but here they're encouraged to take them out and tweet while they're watching you. And it's like, how rude. So I come from a very, you know, different background. So I would say I'm still finding my feet, enjoyably so. I'm really looking forward to getting back into it again. It's going to be a bit of a different show. I'm going to have a new comedy partner as well, because Damien went back to Australia. And we're going to have to look at new numbers and new acts and how we define this new sort of socially distanced sort of role, mm-hmm. which we're thinking and coming up with ideas all the time. I really enjoyed working as a team with the other performers. And, you know, as far as corporate work goes, and I would say, you know, Spiegelworld are very much on the low end of the corporate, and I don't mean low end in a bad way. They are like the mavericks of corporate entertainment. I wouldn't even really deem them as corporate, because I find them to be a very creative, risk-taking company, with lots of ideas and lots of willing to fail, which is what I love about them. But it's the first time I've had a marriage between what would be deemed as corporate and artistry and creativity, which I am really excited about, that I can get paid well and have a lot of creative kind of control.
Well, I think there's something interesting about the size Spiegelworld is at the moment. Like you said, it's just big enough to be a big player, but also small enough to be the smallest in those players. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, knowing Ross pretty well as I do, always Ross's backbone is comedy, and everything in all of Ross's projects is comedy. At least I think he thinks is as the backbone of Absinthe and Opium and Atomic and the other shows.
It's always formed around like a very strong point of view voice as the like leading character who's bringing the audience through the show. And so at what point did you switch the accent to, she has like a Southern accent, right?
Oh, well, that's putting it very loosely. one of the lighting, music man, Rob, said to me, "Where exactly from America are you from?" And I was like, I've traveled the world. So I started with my accent because I was putting on this American accent that was just so bad. And then Cal made me do an English accent, which was awful because it just wasn't right. And then slowly I through being English and just finding my roots of what I am and who I am, then he allowed me to layer the American accent on. But it's been quite a journey. I traveled to America when I was 10 years old. I was sent away when I was 10 because I was just such a nightmare. And my parents put me on a flight on my own to go to America, to Boston, to go and stay with my family in Boston.
That's where I'm from.
Ipswich.
Oh, okay.
I stayed. Yeah. And I went to American high school and I had 6 weeks, 2 months in America. And I came back with American accent because I was so precocious and such a like... And I came back to England. I was like, oh, my God, all the roads are just so small and everything's so small. And I loved an American accent, but I'm not very good at accents. So basically, I just fake it very, very badly. But I think I wanted that to be part of the clown sort of stuff, is that, you know, the accent's so bad that everyone. But that doesn't really, the irony doesn't really come across in that. So it doesn't totally work.
Well, it kind of reminded me of my aunt, who definitely doesn't listen to this podcast, so it's okay, but she's from Texas but then lived almost her whole life in California and Boston, but then will randomly have a Southern accent when like she's around someone else with a Southern accent.
Yes.
And it feels like a very indescript Southern accent that's just like what you think of as a Southern accent.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm from Texas too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh.
I think for me, that's what I kind of want to go towards, is that because with the American accent, like you say, the Southern belle can be very flirtatious and coy and girly. And then, you know, what I call the fuck you, fuck me, fuck you, the soprano, fucking boy, you are the aggressive sort of stuff. And then, you know, another accent can be something else. So I'm very up for sort of changing it as and when the emotion sort of appears, you know, and making that a feature, which is, again, a possibility that I've been thinking about. But right now I've got to wear a mask, so just being heard will be the main sort of key to it.
Right.
How has the COVID lockdown been? Have you found ways to, like, maintain your creative sanity through any kind of, like, non-stage outlets?
Josh, I think on the whole, when I talk to mates in England and mates around the world and friends here, that we've had, I would say, for all intents and purposes, a pretty positive experience. I've been able to be with my kid every night, which I was only with him one night a week, putting him to bed. So story time for me is just beautiful. And I don't let Roger read the story that I'm reading because I get so into it. We've connected with a very dear friend of mine who lives in Arcata, California. So we went and lived in a shed She says it's a hut, but I call it a shed, in the Redwood Forest for 2 months.
Oh, wow.
And we go and visit her regularly. And she's my old schoolmate from when I've known since I was 15, from Canada. And I wouldn't have had that chance to reconnect with her and go swimming in the sea and just do wonderful nature things. I also had a huge honour where I was asked, the school where Richard's at is Mojave Springs School. It's a Steiner school, amazing school. And they very kindly, because of we were in financial crisis, offered Richard a scholarship in return for me working voluntarily at the school, which I have absolutely loved, and full support of this school. And that has been a huge opportunity as a sort of outreach facilitator and a games teacher and just someone who's in support of the school. And in fact, Spiegelworld have been very supportive of that school as well. They did a gala last year organised, and it raised $70,000 for the school, which was lucky because then COVID hit 3 weeks later. So that money went into keeping the school alive rather than a new playground or whatever. And then on top of that, Spiegelworld have sort of opened out a kind of more creative role for me to work on this Vegas shit show, which are these brilliant little 1.5, 2 minute episodes. See? Which happen.
See?
Is it Vegas yeah. hit show or Vegas shit show?
Vegas shit show.
See, this I said it and Josh was like, Lindsay, it is called Vegas hit show. And I was like, I think it's called Vegas shit. Vegas
yeah,
shit show.
Because of the pack. Of course it was Vegas hit show because all their shows are hits with Opium and Atomic and Absinthe. And now it's the Vegas shit show. So it's basically documenting and filming the journey of the pandemic from when it kicked off. I think there's 17 episodes now. I joined at episode 12 and I'm helping to sort of create and inspire material and then crowbar my way into as many episodes as I possibly can. And it's been joyous. It's been totally joyous. I started in beginning of December and it's been joyous because it's like almost a therapy, not just for me but for other performers. So we go into the houses, we get tested before, and we actually go into their houses and sort of have a social and then create material and interview. And it's been really interesting being a fly on the wall, finding out about how other people have coped. And some of the performers I never really got to meet because I was only here for 8 months, so I'm now actually getting to meet them properly. And all of us have this common ground, you know, not only be it Spiegelworld and be performers, but having this unbelievably difficult and often traumatic experience of living through this pandemic away from your family, away from your friends, in a country that you don't know, with a family, no work, about to be evicted. In financial dilemma and coping with that. And I think my thing has been to be incredibly busy. I think I've been more busy during the pandemic than I've been, you know, and I was doing 10 shows a week, but I don't know how, but I've managed to constantly find adventures to do for my family, albeit remote, you know, like going to the Redwoods and living in a shed in Arcata. And I've got lots of family. I've got family in LA who've been incredibly supportive as well, to working at the school, to helping making routines for people as well. I'm going to be working with this brilliant performer, Gypsy Wood, who's in Opium. And I'll start to help her create numbers. And yeah, just sort of, I think also the friendships, people who you don't really know, suddenly you're up against this thing and you get to know people very quickly. You know, albeit that we've all got these small bubbles, but I train with some of the performers and we have sort of supported each other through that and become very, very close in a very dear way, because, you know, there have been times, I'm not going to lie, where I have felt like my world's falling apart, like totally my world's falling apart. How am I going to support my kid? How am I going to put food on the table? Am I going to see my family again? I've got a dad who's got cancer in England and, you know, I can only talk to him on 15 minutes. He doesn't do Skype and he doesn't really like being on the phone. But what I do is I try not to let my heart and my head go to those places, because I would just go to bed and not get up. And I have to get up and I have to keep going. And and you feel the support. I felt huge support from Spiegelworld, and I'm very, very thankful to them, and huge support from my old mates from Zoomanity, and huge support from people, you know, outside of this world. And I think communities come together, even in my neighborhood in McNeil. Like, I just moved in 3 weeks before the pandemic and I had no furniture. I think we had 2 beds and all the neighbors got together because we couldn't go furniture shopping because there were no furniture, you know, and we didn't have any money. And they just put furniture outside of us so that we could use, you know, had a couch to sit on and, you know, some kitchen equipment. And yeah, it's been really heartwarming, I would say. But I am ready. I'm ready to hug people. I've just had my vaccine.
Hey, congrats.
Yeah, I got it through the school because I'm at the school, work with kids. And I'm so ready to hug people again. I'm just itching to feel hugs and warmth and love. And
well, I have a feeling it's going to be a pretty unbelievably cathartic experience once we're all back at shows. Seeing the various kinds of reactions that we all know, you know, theater and circus and comedy can elicit. I do want to ask you the same 3 questions we ask all of our guests that we end off on. The first question is, has there been a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, that has stuck with you?
Gosh. Well, for me personally, and this isn't for everyone because I think street theatre is amazing and I still have lots and lots of mates that are performing and doing incredible stuff. But for me personally, I think the advice from John Wright, who was my theatre teacher, that said, don't get stuck in the street. Because I think for me, he knew that theatre was my love and that, you know, in order to create and make, there's more subtleties that you can find in the theatre. So that was a piece of advice that stuck with me, and I saw it through. And I could have easily stayed as a street performer because I did like the life and it was very easy and I got to travel around the world, but there was something else and I took that risk and didn't work for quite a long time and had no money and all the rest of it. But then I found my way back into theatre again. So that's that first piece of
that answers the question. The second question is, for somebody who's a student of circus or comedy or clowning, is there a book, a movie, a TV show, when we can return to theater, like a live show, that you found very inspiring that you would recommend to somebody?
I don't really read books.
Any kind of artistic media.
Do you know, gonna have to ask Rog. Rog? Oh, what was that film that we just saw that was brilliant that had the Beatles in it? The pretend Beatles that were from Liverpool. Huh? I just saw this film, Walk Hard. And who's it with? J.C. Riley? Yeah, J.C. Riley. Oh, it was so funny. And that, for me, because it's so recent, and I'm a bit thick and I can't really remember things that happened more than a week ago. So that film I just saw, and what I loved about that film, it was like watching comedy on film, the kind of comedy that my monkey adore and love, really stupid, really clown comedy. That, you know, it's possible for those to mix. Everyone's always saying, I can't put what you do in film. And you can. It's just we haven't learned how to do it, but there is a way. And I would say, you know, at the moment, especially with the pandemic, and I'm now working with the Vegas Shit Show and putting all these little film clips together, that this is a medium where you can translate your comedic stuff into filmic, where it's more reachable, especially during this time where theatre might not be live, where you can still, and it's so brilliant with these bloody, you know, iPhones that you can just film. I just film stuff left, right and centre and throw it to Eric and then he edits it and makes it amazing. So I think there is a way to get through this creatively where you don't necessarily have an audience yet, but you can have an audience through this. And I'm not necessarily even saying Zoom, but like TikTok and, you know, all of those kind of things where you can get a platform and you've just got to think cleverly, a little bit out of the box. You know, even just, I don't know, just like my roots are in street performing and there's parts of me that I feel that I just want to go out and do something. Well, I am doing things ridiculous. I'm doing this sort of winter catalogue. I'm calling it my winter COVID catalogue, where I'm getting poor Eric to come and film me my rendition of Autumn, which is basically me dicking about naked in my garden. and him filming me. And I've just done winter, where I managed to get a snow machine. Roger's holding the snow machine. So I'm doing my ode to winter. And whatever crazy idea comes into your head, just to do it and film it, or, and then I just send it to my mates. Do you know what I mean? It's just a way. And they just send me little messages back bang, saying, can I send this to so-and-so? I went, yeah, I don't care. You know, I don't know. It's just any way you can get through is the right way, I would say.
Well put.
I would like to see that calendar. Or the catalog. Okay.
Well, the winter catalog's coming out. I can text it to you.
Great.
Yeah, I'm dressed in cellophane. Well, you'd say cling film. Yeah.
I would love that. And our last question is, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
What next?
Yeah, or at some point. It's kind of a hard question as we get further into our podcast, because now we're at almost 100 guests. But always the suggestions are good, because there's sometimes people that we haven't thought about.
Well, am I allowed to say a spy monkey? I would say one of the spy monkeys. I would say Toby Park or Aitor Basari.
Great.
Aitor Basari, particularly because he is a guru clown teacher. He's amazing. He teaches all around the world. Teaches in New York a lot as well, so you're going to have lots of people in common with him. So yeah, I'd probably say Aitor Farachuba Basari.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, Petra, it's been so much fun talking to you.
And you. It's been very pleasant. Thank you very much.
I can't wait to watch the more episodes of Vegas Shit Show. I've enjoyed them all so far. There was one that came out this morning that was hilarious.
Oh, that's great. Yes, it's great, isn't it? Yeah. We had a different idea and then we pulled it back and that's what happened. I'm really glad you liked it. Yeah, Eric's done an amazing job. He's a brilliant editor. Brilliant. And yeah, the team on board Vegas Shit Show are just great. So we're just running with that.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Petra.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with Petra Maske.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Happy Monday.
Catch you on the next one.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.